What's up, founders, and welcome to the In Demand podcast, where we talk all about how to troubleshoot growth for your PLG SaaS. I'm your co-host, Asia Arangio, the CEO and founder of Demand Maven.
And I'm Kim Talarczyk, client services manager at Demand Maven, where we help SaaS companies reach their toughest growth milestones.
All right, Kim, let's get into it.
Hey, Asia.
Hey.
So I have a topic for today.
Okay.
We just completed a research sprint, as you know, with a client of ours, and we're about to start a new customer research sprint with a new client. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking that since I've been working with you at Demand Maven, how we run these research sprints has changed and evolved over the past 4 or 5 years or so.
Yes. Yes.
So maybe we can start there and talk about that, how it's changed, how we used to do it, and what it kind of looks like now.
Yeah. Yeah. And also the new types of interviews and research that we do now, and because we've expanded that pretty dramatically as well. Yeah. Okay. So I don't even know if you remember how we used to do that back in the day, but I guess I'll take a step back. When it comes to troubleshooting growth, we historically have leveraged jobs to be done as our anchor in terms of how we would conduct research, specifically to gather qualitative insight. And also, eventually, like when we analyze performance data, we're also looking at gathering quantitative insight. But we need qualitative to give context to the quantitative, because numbers can't talk, but people do. When we would gather this qualitative insight, we would use jobs to be done. But it's interesting because now that I'm much more trained in jobs to be done, I look back on those interviews and I think they were jobs inspired. I don't think that they were truly jobs to be done interviews. But back in the day, we used to do 10 interviews with active paying customers. Those are both still relatively true. Now it's probably closer to like 12 to 15, but 10 is the base. And those interviews, we would have a specific set list of questions that we would ask. We would ask them the same way every time. We would not incentivize the interview, like they weren't getting paid to do it. And we also would do this agnostic of the client. So the client would not actually be present in this process. We would do it ourselves. Mm-hmm. We'd kind of go into a black hole of research. And we'd emerge and we'd be like, look what we found. And we make this for you.
Right.
And now we've totally overhauled that process. So now we do a more true jobs interview that is unstructured, but still following the timeline, so to speak, of what was our first thought, what was the switch moment, et cetera. And going into what were the struggles, and more specifically, what were the four forces, pushes, pulls, habits, and anxieties. And we've been doing this for so long now that we don't need a script, but that's actually not how to conduct a jobs interview anyway. Mm-hmm. And like a true jobs to be done interview is not scripted. And that was something that once I really learned jobs from the man himself, Bob Moesta, that was when I realized, not that we were doing it wrong, but that it was not a true jobs interview, and also that we weren't necessarily getting the level of insight that we probably needed to get to make better informed strategic decisions about who these customers were, what they wanted, and how that translated back into the client and their product. And the other thing that we changed was we incentivize them now. We don't do like free interviews anymore. And I think it's because we realized that you attract a certain type of customer when you say this is actually not incentivized. I used to think it was the opposite, where if you incentivize it, you're going to attract a certain type of person anyway. But when you offer a gift card for the interview, you're still going to attract your best paying customers, but you're also going to attract people that you probably wouldn't have heard from anyway. If you don't offer a gift card, you're only going to get people who have goodwill and aren't going to be totally honest with you about what's wrong with your product, if anything, which there probably are some things. And I realized, oh man, when we don't offer the gift card, it's very possible that we were getting insights from people who had a natural selection bias of, of, oh, we care and we want to help. And that is a very different type of insight than someone who, you still get that when you offer the gift card, but you also get people again who are a little bit more like real with you about what their buying context was and how they really view your product. And now that I see the other side of the fence, I'm like, actually, the grass is greener over here, because I'd rather have both than just the one. And if you don't offer a gift card, you get the one. The other thing that we did that we changed was Bob Molesta, he showed me the light on this, but he was like, he had a mentor, and I'm not going to remember his name, but he had a mentor that really encouraged him to focus on how to tighten up these sprints of research, because you do something for 3 months and everyone's already forgotten what your initiative was. Nobody really cares anymore. And you've already moved on to something else. But if you tighten it down to a week, now we're cooking with grease. And it really fundamentally changed, I think, how our projects operated. It used to be it would take 3 to 4 weeks just to even get the interviews done. Now we book it into a week and a half, and it's intense. It's a lot of fun. And usually by the end of it, I'm exhausted, but we have the benefit of getting it all done in a really short amount of time.
And also the client is now joining these calls.
That's the other thing that we changed. So it used to be we would go on a black hole and yeah, like resurface later and be like, look, we did all this research. We got all these insights. But I've learned over the years, and I've been running Demand Maven now for 7 going on to 8 years. Next February will be 8 years, which is wild to think about. But in my years of running Demand Maven, I have learned that most people aren't going to listen to the recordings. Most people also aren't going to really extract like what they need to extract on their own. And as the experts, it's really our job to ensure that they absorb this information in whatever way that they need to absorb it, because otherwise they're going to walk away from the project feeling like, okay, Demand Maven did stuff, but we don't really, and we got some documents at the end of it, but there was almost like a knowledge gap, it felt like. And I think it was harder, actually. Like, we were making it harder for our clients to really absorb the information, but then also feel confident in making strategic decisions behind it, because they weren't actually part of the process. Mm-hmm. And we're making all these decisions almost without them. Mm-hmm. And we're gathering all these insights without them. And now they actually attend the sprint. And we used to make the argument like, actually, the interviews are better when the team is not present. That was true when there wasn't a gift card. But what we found was when you incentivize the interview, it kind of doesn't really matter. People genuinely forget that there are other people on the call anyway. And we learned that, and I learned, there really is no way to eliminate bias. There's always going to be some bias, because they're humans. Like, it doesn't matter how you conduct it. Even the fact that you're conducting it online is a bias that creates. I mean, there's just so much that, like, there's no way to eliminate it. And once I kind of realized that, I kind of was like, what matters is that people get the most out of this insight, that we attract the biggest variety of people who are in the happy paying customer bucket. And also now, like, we actually try to include even people sometimes who churn, because we want to create a churn pattern that we can then create like an anti-customer around, if that makes any sense, or like an anti-persona. And so we've actually even broadened that. But all that to say, we include the client in the process now. And maybe I'm biased, but I can see the difference in how people engage after we go through that process.
Yeah. And it's not only more efficient, but the client we're working with also knows their product the best, better than us. And it's sometimes nice. I think we've seen throughout the process, their feedback or their insights that we may not know yet, just because we haven't been in their business for that long, helps us, right? Tweak and adjust as well, or be like, oh, okay, they might tell us something like, oh yeah, we hear that a lot, or, and then we know, oh, this is something to continue to dive into.
Similar also when customers ask for things that already exist in the product, And then later the founder or the client will be like, we actually do that. And then that tells us, you might have a product marketing problem, or you might have a like feature distribution problem. Like there's an awareness issue about things that you already have in your product. And that's an opportunity for growth because it's tough to get the attention of anybody, but it signifies, there might be an issue with this and it might be causing churn or inactivity of some kind. And it's purely an education gap. And it is tough to solve, but it is at least a concrete thing to solve. So yeah, absolutely. Having clients part of the process does make it better. Even though there are more folks on the call, as long as the operations are done in a particular way, like the only people who have their cameras on are the customer that you're interviewing and then the interviewer themselves. Everyone else has camera off. It's actually really easy to forget that there are other people on the line anyway. So I actually think it still creates a good experience, and the customer doesn't feel like they're being interrogated by six people. The lead interviewer is the lead interviewer, and they open it up for questions at the end, but it's really between the customer and the interviewer, and that's preserved, and it opens it up at the end of the call. We just find that makes a much better experience overall. And then again, the customer doesn't feel like they're being interrogated by six people at once or whoever is on the call. But I'll have to say, yeah, like we've changed that as well. Our deliverables and our artifacts have always changed over the years, but those have become a lot more simplified. And I think in the jobs to be done world, we debrief after every interview now. And we didn't used to do that. Mm. So not just having the client attend the call, like attend the interview, but now we introduce a debrief. And again, this is purely from Bob Moesta's recommendation, because he was like, it doesn't make sense to do a jobs interview. You keep all the insights in your head and you don't actually teach the team like how to think like you're thinking. And we actually map the four forces now at the end of every call. And then we try to map what we think the job is of the customer or the jobs. There's usually several. But I find like we really don't get a good sense of that until like interview number four or five, but we do try to map live. And I also think like that helps the client see how we're seeing it, and it helps give them language. And now they can start to apply that to other areas of the business, whether it's marketing, content marketing, product marketing, demand generation, and then you get into product management, product discovery. Yeah.
And they're getting takeaways in real time and can kind of apply it in their current day to day.
Exactly. Well. Exactly. And when we debrief, we document what we think potential action items or projects are. And so by the end of the sprint, nobody feels confused about, okay, what did we learn? We know what we learned. It's here. It's documented. We did it live together. The next step then is to prioritize and to figure out, okay, and also to shape. So we got to shape the project or shape what we think is next. And now we prioritize it. And now we start putting things in the pipeline. So the sprint that we just did, for example, shaping that into campaigns and then also content management or content marketing, that's really like the next big thing. And now that we have an understanding for the jobs, I'm now thinking, the website needs to get adjusted. The messaging on the site needs to get adjusted. We also need to think about our content marketing process and how do we prioritize ideas that are closer to the jobs that we know are profitable to solve. And similarly, let's start with the product and reverse engineer the process a little bit on what we think is going to be valuable for people based, again, on the jobs that they want to accomplish. And also what we literally heard, because people do describe specific features that help them ultimately accomplish their jobs when it comes to the product, at least. So that's the jobs to be done process. There are so many other things that we do now that have some element of jobs, are not like a true jobs interview, because a true jobs interview takes an hour by itself. You're digging so deep into all the different nuts and bolts of how this person, like what they were doing before, the moment that triggered their switch, like their very first thought, all the way down into they've made progress and now they're in this new paradigm and like what's pushing them forward and holding them back. That can take an hour easily. But there are other interviews and types of qualitative insights gathering that we do now that have an element of jobs, but it's not like a true jobs interview because we have another focus.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are those? Because we offer those and we didn't used to.
Yeah, we didn't. And I guess I could talk a little bit about why we... So jobs is amazing as a approach to understanding what drives customers. But it's not going to be able to do everything, right? We wouldn't expect jobs to be done, for example, to show you UX gaps. Mm-hmm. Could it influence them? Could it help you understand what does someone want to accomplish like on this page? Sure. But the only thing, in my opinion, that helps you understand UX gaps is a UX interview. But what's interesting is we like to sprinkle in a little bit of jobs interviewing in a lot of what we do. So there are other types of research formats or modalities that we do now too. And one of those is a UX interview. There's also, we help teams sometimes with product discovery. Sometimes there's like a team might struggle with understanding like what are our other expansion opportunities that we just don't know about. Or we know about them, but we don't really know, like, how do we prioritize them based on what we're hearing? Then there's also things like maybe there's a new feature that the team wants to launch, but there's not really been any requirements gathering around it. And that requires like talking to just like a handful of people. Mm-hmm. There's churn interviews that we do now where especially we do this, especially if a company is struggling with churn. So there's And to me, that would be anything above 4-5% month over month. So mm-hmm. if you've got like a 10% monthly churn, I might recommend we should do some churn interviews where we talk to people who have canceled and make sure that we understand what creates a pattern. What's the pattern that creates someone to cancel, and how much control realistically do we have over that? Because if we have a lot more control, then it's something that we should address. And if we don't have control, then it needs to feed back into go-to-market. So there's something about that type of customer that we need to make sure we make it clear that this product either is not for them, or we figure out some kind of way to disqualify them from our metrics. So maybe your total churn per month is a number, but your qualified churn is a different number. And that's kind of where like we might help strategically guide a team into making that decision. But anyway, and then there's also competitive intelligence, which is underrated. It's one of my favorite types of research to do because literally you're just interviewing people who use competitive tools and you find them. And really for all of these types of interviews and research that I wish more teams did, and I think better performing teams probably do in some kind of way, even if it's a scrappy way of doing it. But the way that you do these and source some of these prospects or people to talk to would be platforms like userinterviews.com. Respondent.io is also really popular. But yeah, we've added quite a lot. And part of it was just because I realized jobs is amazing, but it can't do everything. And a lot of the times we would hit these speed bumps along the way with troubleshooting growth. And I'd realize like the qualitative insight that we need is not like, yes, jobs, like we'll need jobs, but we also need to really just watch someone use the product and conduct more of a true like UX interview. Or sometimes, yes, we can do jobs to be done over here, but sometimes like we need to just talk to some users of some competitors and really like to understand like how they kind of view the landscape or how like what's like working about the product and what's not.
Okay. But the UX interviews, are you talking to non-customers using a respondent.io or a user interviews?
It depends on the goals. So for example, the selection panel of who we actually interview always depends on the goals, but the modality is for the most part pretty straightforward. Usually like we're bringing someone, we're interviewing them, we're getting context about them, we're doing a little bit of a jobs interview, mostly just to understand their context and what are they hoping to accomplish in general. And then we want to watch them actually navigate the product in some kind of way. Now, when it comes to an activation challenge, so let's say we're struggling with our onboarding or our activation rates in general, I might not prioritize customers in this scenario because they're already familiar with the process. And most customers probably aren't, like, unless they are like product people or people who live and breathe SaaS, they're probably not going to be able to tell you what's like wrong, so to speak, with your onboarding experience or your sign up flow or what have you. Mm-hmm. So I like to use prospects who are very close to who we'd want to actually acquire in the first place, but they don't have to be perfect, because one thing about UX is that it's relatively universal. Of course, different cultures have different UX experience expectations. However, because of technology, we all mostly have similar expectations for how things should look and feel and what's intuitive versus not. That is, I don't want to say relatively, I guess it is relatively universal. I'll say that. It's not perfectly universal, but for the most part, it's pretty relative. So they don't have to be a perfect buyer, so to speak, but they do need to be pretty close. And you don't need a ton of these. You just need 3 to 5 of these types of interviews. I do believe in gathering more qualitative insight up front. I know some teams like to just run like a purist UX interview, which it's okay, like, what's your name? What's your job title? Okay, great. Now you're going to go and immediately start using the product and like to start doing stuff, and we'll give you prompts and blah, blah, blah. I like to actually interview them. Like, who are you? What do you do? Like, we do, like I said, we sprinkle a little bit of jobs in there because the context does matter. I'm a very firm believer in that. And it also helps us weigh certain decisions and based on the contextual implications of the person that we're talking to. The more qualified someone is to us, the more that feedback that they have resonates to us. Right. The less qualified, the less. But it's still important because, again, UX is relatively universal to an extent. Obviously, there are some cultures that have completely wildly different UX experiences and expectations culturally. Like, graphic design in Latin America looks completely different than graphic design in America. So, mm-hmm. All that to say, there are obviously differences. But yeah, so that's an example of UX interviews, but who we actually talk to, it does depend on what the goal is. And that can obviously, that just has implications. So there's a company that we worked with where they had 2 different types of customers, and they were really like 2 completely different segments. And they were really struggling with, do we focus on these guys or do we focus on these guys? Or even like, can we keep both? What does that look like? But what was challenging for them was they were really struggling with kind of trying to appeal to the masses. And we knew that those 2 segments were at odds almost. And it was causing, it was making it really tough for them to go to market effectively, because these 2 segments have diametrically opposed desires. And that can be very conflicting and confusing for a founder and their team. And when we conducted the research, our selection panel was, we want to talk to customers over here. We want to talk to customers over here. And ideally, we talk to people who have churned, just generally speaking, because you might have a very excited group of customers, but they still might not be the best fit, because when they cancel later, they're like the worst. You just never know. And that can create like an anti-pattern, so to speak. Oh, this is a pattern of customer that, but like their context in some way, it's not their fault, but their context creates maybe a negative outcome. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we want to make sure we bring into the qualification process and also the go-to-market process. So that was like our selection panel for that. We were more strategic about who we talked to because of the goals of that or the challenges of that particular client. Mm-hmm. So selection panel obviously changes. That's also something too that was really different. We used to just kind of talk to the same types of people. But I think over the years, I realized like, it doesn't make sense depending on what the problem is or even like what the aspiration is for a particular company. Mm-hmm. It might make more sense actually to be more strategic about who we select in this process, because we might be accidentally missing some crucial part of the story that fundamentally changes how we think about growth and go to market, which has happened. We have been certainly surprised by information in our work, and it does have a pretty big impact on like the recommendations that we make and how we kind of see the growth engine in that way.
Yeah. What else?
I think that the interviews that I wish more teams did, and I'm really speaking to my bootstrapped clients here and my bootstrapped founders on this one. Because sometimes we've got an episode that should be already out by now, but we have an episode about how like things are figure outable. Mm-hmm. And I do think that there's an over-reliance sometimes on the quantitative metrics, but quant cannot talk. Numbers don't talk. And I think they certainly can help weave a story, but you're just never going to get the why behind those numbers. And I think it's crucial that you get the why. I don't think jobs is enough, though. I think you have, like, jobs to be done is not enough. I think you also have to start thinking about conducting the occasional batch of UX interviews, especially if you struggle with activation. Conducting the occasional batch of churn interviews. These are the interviews that I wish more people did. Collecting cancellation reason, also not enough. We have interviewed thousands of customers, and I can guarantee that it wasn't one reason why your customer churned. I would bet you all the money that I have in my bank account right now that it was probably like 4 to 5 things. But when they hit that cancellation reason, this happens to me all the time. When I cancel SaaS products, I'm like, and it's because I'm aware, but I'm like, there were 10 things that happened. And a lot of it wasn't in your control. But just saying, I don't need the product anymore is not accurate enough, in my opinion. But you got to collect a cancellation reason, fine. I'm not saying you shouldn't collect a cancellation reason, but I am saying you shouldn't go more than 6 months without talking to a handful of churned customers to really dig deep into what's actually going on, especially for reasons that are relatively within your control. So some products do have built-in churn, like you only can use it for a certain amount of time. Fine. But that might be a solvable problem. And I think accepting built-in churn, maybe we should have a healthy questioning of it every now and again. But I say that because if you want subscription-based revenue to work for you, you've got to keep people for a longer amount of time. And if you're not charging that much, your ACVs are relatively lower, your LTVs are relatively lower. That means you've either got to figure out how to increase your price and in a way that's beneficial, or you've got to figure out how you keep people for much longer and acquire for people for much less. And you just can't play that game if you don't understand like churn reasons and like at a very deep level, because like I said, I guarantee you that one little line of cancellation reason is not enough.
Yeah. And I'm surprised at how often we've heard this, where you've asked someone, have you talked to your customers when they churn? Oh, yeah, we do. We get a cancellation reason. Or maybe there's like a quick call from a customer rep or something. And we'll do churn interviews that can last 45 minutes. And they're sort of mind blown at what we've extracted. Definitely a big difference if you think you're getting churn explanations.
Totally.
You're probably not.
Totally. And there's so much buried deep within that. And founders are busy. I get it. But I think if you're chief of your business, you should probably care a lot about retention. That is what makes a SaaS business a SaaS business. Otherwise, you should not be SaaS. If retention is not a concern, you shouldn't be a SaaS company. You should be like a one-time buy or something else. But if you're subscription-based or SaaS, you have to care about retention at a very deep, intimate level. And I just wouldn't accept the churn reason is a surface level. You got to dig deeper and figure out, again, what's controllable and what's not controllable. And for stuff that's not controllable, is there an anti-pattern present where there's a certain qualification metric here that means that certain customers shouldn't even get into the pipeline, or you figure out how to measure qualified versus unqualified churn, which is a different play on the same concept. So even like your monthly churn number is actually not your real churn number. And that's something that I wish more founders knew about and thought about and would push to measure, because it does fundamentally change how you think about go-to-market.
Yeah. Is there, so churn interviews, you're seeing people don't do enough, you wish they did more. Is there another type that we talked about?
I wish more teams did competitive intelligence interviews. This is so underrated. And I'm going to put win-loss in this as well. Win-loss interviews are, and again, a lot of people think it's just like a couple of questions, but you can run a win-loss interview for literally an hour. But win-loss gets into the details and specifics, of why did someone become a customer? What were the things about it that made them choose this specific product? And what were the things about it that made them not choose our product? And win-loss is a deep dive. It's usually associated with a sales process, but you can do this for PLG, product-led growth companies as well. But win-loss is a very deep process because you're asking live on a call customers or prospects, I should say, to really rank certain features and then also to get specific with you about this feature versus that feature in different products. That's a more true win-loss process. A lot of people kind of bake it down to just like asking a couple of questions in a call. But really, it's actually like there's a whole world of win-loss that people just don't know. The flip side of this is competitive intelligence, which is my personal favorite. Win-loss is fascinating, but I get really excited about competitive intelligence because you're literally just talking to people who use your competitor's product. And you're really understanding. I mean, yeah, like you want to dig up dirt, obviously. Like you want to be like, what sucks about these guys? But what you really want is you really want to understand what type of customer are they attracting and how is that fundamentally different than mine? And how can I make that difference clear in my positioning and my messaging? Mm. Similarly, you might discover that actually you have a ton of overlap in your customer base. So then you want to might dig deeper into, okay, how do I make sure that we differentiate ourselves? And what's the impression that my competitors have made? What's the impression that we're making? You might even kind of turn it into a UX interview in a way and get them to review your site, especially if you're finding that like you have the literal same type of buyer. But if you don't have the same type of buyer, that's where it gets really interesting to me because that's where you can get even deeper into, oh, like this type of company, like QuickBooks is attracting this type of customer. But Xero attracts this type of customer. And there might be some overlap, but there also might not. Like there might be very clear differentiators. And I think that you can take that back to pretty much every single part of your go-to-market process. Mm. And I think that's what is so interesting about competitive intelligence. And it's underrated. No one's really doing this, I think, at a meaningful level. I don't even think people are thinking about this. I was talking with the CEO of a company that we're working with. And he was saying that he really wants to do competitive intelligence, but in a different way. He wants to talk to ex-employees of his competitors and get insights that way of like, what are they doing? What are they cooking up? What works? What doesn't work? How do they do this? How do they do that? And I was like, ooh, that's very cool and so smart. And happens probably way more than you think. But I'm thinking about all the people who aren't, like, who could be doing that type of thing and just aren't. Like, they're not competitive intelligence. I mean, it is tough to prioritize because it's like, who does that? Whose responsibility is it to do competitive intelligence unless, like, you have a BI team or whatever? But I would be thinking, like, if sales can't conduct something like this or marketing can't conduct something like this, It's got to be either of those teams or product, but someone should be doing some level of competitive intelligence at some frequency, because it is so powerful. And again, I wish more people were doing it. But I think part of the challenge is just one, prioritizing it; two, understanding like what's the outcome of something like that, and like how much does it really impact what you do. And I'm going to say it's immense. When we've done it, it's been game changers. It's been the difference between looking like everybody else and standing out. And I think like everybody wants to stand out. Otherwise, you just blend in with all the other bajillion SaaS companies. And now that AI exists, there's going to be even more because they're going to pop up overnight. Mm-hmm. And it's important not to just be like another lookalike product. And I think like competitive intelligence can help you do that. And you, again, don't need a lot. You just need a handful. You need to be clear on what your objective is. But for the most part, it's something that you can very easily do. And I mentioned userinterviews.com and also respondent.io. Those are both great platforms to leverage that are relatively low cost. There are other platforms like Winter. So if you have like a bigger budget, you could use something like Winter. But I think the first two platforms are great to start if you don't have a very big budget.
Yeah.
I'm curious if there are any questions on this, but so many different changes that we've made and also research that I wish more people were doing. Obviously, we do all these things and more. There are, like, we didn't talk about pricing interviews, but we do those too. Those are fun. But there are ways to get insights that you need to make better decisions that don't require a heavy lift. And I think that's the part that I want to communicate to the masses, is this doesn't need to take 6 months. It could literally take a couple of hours, and you could be talking to people in days and getting insights, and it just doesn't have to be a blocker. And then if you need support on how to make sense of all of this, what type of insights do you need, et cetera, obviously we're open books. I'm here to answer questions, but this is accessible and it does not have to be this like overbearing thing. Alrighty. Thanks again.
All right. Thanks, Asia. Good topic. All right.